Good morning, everyone. My name is Joyce Robinson, and my home group is the Sneed Road Al-Anon Family Group. It meets on Tuesdays and Fridays at 8 o'clock, so if you're up Franklin Way, we'd love to have you. Good morning. I've decided my nickname is to be Tripper. Tripper. Now, if you... No, not stripper. Tripper. Woo. And the reason is I seem to love to trip. And I'll tell you why that comes to my mind this morning. I had to seek out the necessary room before about 15 minutes ago. And they told me where to go and opened the door. And my eyes immediately saw this great big yellow sign, but my foot didn't see it. And this big yellow sign already inside the room says, "Caution. Watch your step," or "caution step," something like that. And I didn't see it in time, and I tripped over the step. Now, if I was talking to the taper guys back there last night, I have been known to trip at the most inopportune times. So I've decided that maybe that's just my nickname for the rest of my life. If there's something out there, I'll trip on it, and that is true. I'm really glad to be here. It's been a while since I've done this. I can't believe it's already May. This year has been an interesting one for me, one in which I really got to use every principle I've ever learned in this program, but in a different way. If you told me 35 or 40 years ago that I'd be doing this anywhere, I would have simply laughed in your face and said, "There is no way." I was not a person that anyone would have asked me to speak, or any of you would have asked me to speak. Life is so interesting, and it has taken me on a journey that was not a thing like I really ever dreamed that my life would be. I thought that life for me was going to be some sort of, well, it was really a fantasy. A lot of young girls are brought up to think that life is going to be so simple, and you are going to marry this wonderful guy and live in a little house with a white picket fence, and life was going to be good. The kids were never going to act out. It was going to be that way. But I learned that God has different paths for us. If you had told me I was going to marry someone who would have the disease of alcoholism, I would have said, "What is that?" I had this vague impression about what the disease of alcoholism is, and I certainly didn't want to marry somebody who drank that way. And I grew up in a family of really fine, good people, taught me wonderful values. A mom and dad, and I have an older sister. And my house contained no booze whatsoever, except for a little jar in the far back of the kitchen cabinet that I was told was used to mix with honey for when we got colds or coughs. And I was always the one that did get the cold and the cough. So, it was forbidden. That's back there, it's in the corner, and you don't touch. So I learned quickly in my family to follow rules. And I also learned very quickly that if I went against those rules, I would get caught. And that was a really basic learning behavior for me. I remember as a child doing something that my mother said, "You do not do that," and I did it, and I got caught, and it was, I was traumatized by that. So you just follow the rules. That was easy. Okay, I can do that. Well, the thing about my parents was, and they were wonderful people, but our lives were solely in the church. That was my parents' Sunday, Wednesday, Sunday, Wednesday, Sunday, Wednesday, Sunday, Wednesday, always, and we had to go. That was life in those days, and our social life was also the members of the church. And I thought that was well and good, but there was always that sense about me that said, there's some more excitement out there in the world. And I want to know what that's like. So I got to experience some of that and a lot more. When I graduated from college, my mom said, both of you girls are going to school. You're going to further your education. It's the only way to do this. I want you to have more than what we've had. I was a child of World War II, and as was my sister. And, you know, the truth is, we, like so many families in those days, we had very little of material things. We had lots of wonderful family values that there's no price that can be put on that. But I always wished for more. Began to learn much later that that could be a problem for me. Nevertheless, mother said, you're going to school, and dad, he really thought we would just, you know, get married and start a family. And I said, nah, I really want to go to school. So my sister and I both proceeded to go to college, and I had fun. I learned what fun was. It was where I drank my first beer. And I had to learn it, y'all. Now, those of you in this room that enjoyed your first drink, I hated it, and I wondered why people drank this stuff. But you see, I had to fit in, and I hadn't felt like I fitted in anywhere because there was so much of the world I didn't know, and I was afraid. I couldn't have said that I was afraid, but I was afraid of what was out there, and yet there was a piece of me that said, it's okay, you know, go try. So as I'm going to leave this, the part and another part too, for Tom to tell later on, because we have different versions of it. But I do, you know, I learned to drink beer. And when you got to be a senior, you had senior privileges in the house at school. And the senior privileges amounted to being able to go to the coffee beer house and drink beer. And we could do that on Thursday nights. That's when the college dorms, well, I was in a fraternity, I mean a sorority house, but still, even if you were in a dorm, it was girl dorms, guy dorms, you know, unlike it is today. Things have really changed. It begins to show you my age there. Nevertheless, I learned to drink it, and I learned another valuable lesson about life. You know, if you drank, you weren't bad. I was drinking beer, and I didn't consider myself a bad person. And I realized that was a message I'd gotten from my parents. Now, they never directly said that. That if you drank, you weren't good. But I just heard stories of Uncle So-and-so or, you know, somebody that I probably didn't even know way back in the family. So I just sort of thought, well, I guess the assumption is that people, if you drink, you're just going to be hooked on it. And I realized I could take it or leave it. It wasn't a big deal to me. Had absolutely no craving, if anything. I thought, So graduated from college, waited to get a job, and after the summer, after graduation, I really wasn't ready to leave college. I know today that I was terribly naive and terribly emotionally immature when I left, mostly because I think that I just had never experienced much of life. We were, you know, Tom and I have talked about that numerous times. I think I was just really protected as a child. And I think Mom and Dad were just kind of concerned about the world and what was happening to it. So they protected us from it. So I had to get I needed some excitement in my life. My first job, I ended up in what is now the location of Walt Disney World. But in those days, it was Lakeland, Florida. Graduated from a university in Florida. But the better one of all of them, of course. Where's Sam? There's Sam. He knows what school I went to. And I loved FSU. It was a great school, and I really wasn't ready to get out in the world, but, you know, I had to move on. There was no more money. And my family, we all worked for everything hard, for anything we got. So I decided I needed to move to Hot Atlanta. That's what it was called in those days, maybe still is, because there was a lot of excitement there, so I was told, and I'm still seeking that excitement, you know. So I get this, what was really and still is a good job, and moved to Atlanta, and hadn't been there very long when I decided that I would really look cool if I had a new Mustang. That would make me look even more cool. Still looking to fit in and to be better, and sometimes I think members of AA think they've got it all over us, that you all are the only ones that feel different. But for this Al-Anon member, by the way, I felt that way. And so I bought this brand new Mustang, and the guy that sold it to me was a young man, nice young man, and he called me one day and he said, "Joyce, I got a friend coming home from the in the military, he's getting out, and I just thought maybe you might like a blind date." Well, I was not interested in getting serious with anybody. I had really just arrived in Atlanta, and I wanted fun, and I wanted to meet people and to date, you know, brand new people, and living in this exciting place. And so I said, "Well, okay." My job was such that I had to work 12-hour days, once or twice a week. It was long, and on that particular day, I wasn't feeling very well. But I had this long day to work, and I was taught to be responsible and reliable and dependable in all ways. So, you know, I worked this long day, even though I wasn't feeling well. And that happened to be the day of this date. And I remember thinking, if I had his phone number, I'd call him and cancel. But I didn't. And so the deal was, I was to meet him at a bar after work in downtown Atlanta. I would never do that. I don't think I'd do that today. Never say never. So I met him in a bar, and he says that I had more beers than he had. Maybe I did. I don't know. I just remember two. He remembers more than that, but maybe it's, I don't know. I was always in control. You see, that's another part of me that I learned in my fourth step inventory, the very first one. Got to be in control. There was one time in my life when I can honestly say that I was drunk. And it was after a college graduation, and we all went out and partied, and I mixed drinks. I'd never done that before. I remember going home and laying on the bed in my parents' home, and the bed is going round and round, and I went, "Oh my God, I don't want to do this anymore." Never, never. And I never did. And I never did. And I couldn't understand why people thought that was fun. And so I truly only remember two. But maybe in his excitement, he remembers more than that. I don't know. We continued to date, and people ask me when I'm doing newcomers, by the way, "Didn't you ever see him drunk?" And I didn't. And the truth was, he never was with me. He was never drunk. He never overdrank that I ever saw. And I think that I would have noticed that, because remember, I don't really know what overdrinking or excessive drinking or alcoholism is. I think I would have noticed some of that. Nevertheless, we continued to date. We were going to get married a year or something. Anyway, it got pushed up. And about 9 months later, we get married, and my world changed. As far as I was concerned, he changed. And I will tell you snippets of him as I saw them. My perception. I do believe we have a disease of that I suffer from the disease of perception. And this is so my story is one of what I saw or thought I saw, my understanding. Things really changed. We both worked at the same company. It was a very large company. And we'd go home at night, and he always had drinks. Well, I'd never experienced that before. And all of that. I mean, it was not just every now and then, it was every night. And then it got to be more and more then, you know, more than one, more than two, more than three, and then it was asleep in the chair, and I'm going, well, it was never this way. It was never this way before. So we have jokes about that today, you know. I'll let him tell you some of those things. But it began to be a concern to me. It began to be a concern. And so I in those days, I talked too much. I still do, I suppose. But I remember saying to him one time, you know, don't you think that you could slow down on the alcohol? And he said to me, I don't really think I drink too much. And then the story changed to one that sounded like, Joyce, I just got back from Southeast Asia, and I saw some terrible things over there, and I have these nightmares, and I have to have this in order to sleep. Well, that made sense to me. You know, I thought, well, okay. And I thought that would end, and it didn't. And I began to realize that this relatively new bride had a different husband, and I thought, I don't know what to do here. What is going on? And so I began to feel not so important to him in his life, and that really concerned me. That was the beginning of a very long journey for me, and he'll tell you his journey, but it was the beginning of a long journey of living with alcoholism. And I did not. I remember periodically being able to say to him, don't you think you're drinking too much? And his responses began to be much more defensive. I don't drink too much. I wish you'd stop that nagging. I wish you would stop. And I just thought I had the answer to his dilemma if he could just hear me, you know. If I said it one more time, maybe he would hear me. And so I continued to say those things, those kinds of things. I remember even noticing some bizarre behavior. And I thought, you know, there were periods of time when I was in true denial. It's not alcoholism. And then some bizarre behavior would occur, and I'd say, yes, it is. And then I'd say, something else would happen, and I'd say, no, it's not. And then, yes, it is. So I waffled in this confusion, wondering, is it or isn't it? So I realized in getting into this program much later that that's really, that confusion is a part of denial. You know, I couldn't have married an alcoholic. After all, I grew up in a non-drinking home. There's no way I could do that. I was to learn that I was not unique. There were many other wives and children and parents of people who had the disease of alcoholism. I lived in denial, became very angry. If any of you know what that feels like, trying to control, you can't control, you know. I love doing newcomer meetings because I get to share with them one-on-one how our insanity looks. So I'll give you a few verbal descriptions of what my insanity looked like. He became my obsession. He became my higher power, and I let it. I let him become the higher power. I had to know if he was drinking. I had to know. Because if I knew, then we could then spar better with each other, the arguments. You know, yes, you have. No, I haven't. Yes, you have been drinking. No, you haven't. I know because I just put a mark on the Jack Daniels bottle where you ended last night. I know. You know, and deluded, you know, the things that our literature talks about, I did. Now, I will say, where's Michelle? I did not go to the bars. I did not do that. I mean, this person does not do that. But I would have if I thought no one else could find out. And then he would find out, and then that would be terrible. Couldn't let him know what I knew. So this began to be a huge game. And this went on for quite some time. I honestly believe, I would, part of my insanity was that I believed I had to hold dinner for him. I mean, you know, and he was pretty, if anybody that knows him knows that he is orderly and timely, and he will do what he tells you to do, even if he's in bad shape. He will do it. And he would show up, but you could just look at him. I heard one time somebody's talking about the kiss and sniff. I would kiss with a sniff so I could determine if he had been drinking, you see? And this was a daily thing with me. I had to know. I've got a sponsee that's been going through that whole issue of having to know. And I as much as I felt controlled, and I was, he has a really strong personality. I allowed him to control me. I allowed him to be the king of our house, and whatever was said or done, even if you didn't like it, was what you did. We learned to be people pleasers. We learned a lot of dysfunctional behavior as a result of living with active alcoholism. I heard someone describe it one time, living with active alcoholism is like a big old dog that comes in out of the rain, and he comes in and he just shakes all over. And all the rain, just all the water on his coat, just gets on everybody around. And I heard that used to describe alcoholism, and I thought, that's it. I've heard people in newcomers meetings say, "My kids are fine. They're not even bothered with their dad or their mom. They're fine." I thought, just you wait, you know. In some way, for those in there, some of us in here have been Alateen sponsors, which, by the way, for those of you who might not know, is for young teens whose lives have been affected by alcoholism. That's an incredible experience to be an Alateen sponsor. My perception is they either become underachievers, I don't care, I hate you, or the overachievers who are going to show that they're perfect and they can do no wrong, and maybe mom or dad will love me better if I'm perfect. And so they waffle, you know, they just waffle amongst all that. By this time, I'll backtrack a tad bit to say that we had decided when we were, actually, I don't know, may have been before marriage or after, that if there was a chance that we might not be able to have children, that we would adopt. Wasn't even an issue. Well, the unthinkable happened. And in those days, a lot of the technology and the medical knowledge and all was not as well-known and well-researched. And we're both the kind of people that we sort of accept what is, and that seemed to be, you know, what it was. We determined, not a problem, here we go, we're going to adopt. And in less than a year, we had a little boy. We got a little boy who was 3 days old. And what a thrilling experience. But here's another aha moment for me. You know, when you bring a new baby home, our little baby has left the room here, I guess. But when you bring them home from the hospital and everybody's rejoicing and happy, and when we brought him home from the hospital, Tom got drunk. And I went, I don't believe this. I just don't believe this. Now, he's an only child, and I'm have just that one sister, and there was nobody close to us physically, geographically, that could help us except Tom's mother, and I wasn't going to tell her that I couldn't handle this baby. But the truth of it is, it's been somewhat recent years, I realized that my anger was really fear that Tom wasn't present, emotionally present for me, when we brought him home from the hospital. And I realized I was scared to death. I didn't know what to do with this child. I'd never been a babysitter, except for older kids. I didn't know what to do. Nevertheless, that was an aha moment. I thought, he is. He's got a drinking problem. And so life for us proceeded, and we made some moves, all of them good moves, for our family, or what seemed to be good moves. We had an opportunity to move to Tennessee, and wasn't really sure whether that was a good move or not. I know that I've heard other people say this. It's was very true for me. You know, I thought that when we moved, everything is going to be fine. Geographic change, I hear you all talk about that. Life is going to be different. We're going to start all over again, a brand new chapter, a brand new page. Everything's going to be wonderful. He's not going to fall off the stools at parties. He's not going to embarrass me. He's not going to humiliate me. We're going to be fine. So denial crept back in periodically throughout the time. We moved to Tennessee. More money, better job, or it seemed. And when we got here, each time, by the way, of our moves, they were always situations where I was left behind and he would go to wherever the new place was and start the job, and I was left to take care of the house and see that it was sold and all of that. And so we had spent almost a year apart. We came to Tennessee from Richmond, Virginia, and I was ready for the new life, and when I got here, life was worse than I could have ever dreamed. I realized that, and I was so saddened. Now, by this time, I knew there was this thing called Al-Anon, but I wanted so badly to believe it really wasn't happening to me and to us. Tom's drinking was something similar to 24/7. And he'd never done that before, so I thought, and it scared me to death. Didn't know what to do. There really were some funny times in there, and perhaps he'll tell you some funny times. You know, I'm making it sound as if it was sad and horrible, but there were funny times in there, and you know, I couldn't believe some of the things that happened, but. You know, I keep thinking, you know, my mom and dad, what would they think? You know, and I was always concerned about what other people thought of me. You know, what will they think? How could I have married this drunk? I will tell you that one of our stays, so to speak, was in Charlotte, North Carolina. And that was a particularly bad time for our family. I secretly called a central office AA number, and I could hardly get the words out of my mouth. I think I might have married someone who has a problem with alcohol. And he said to me, well, if you'll meet me at this church on Providence Road, we can have a talk. And I went, I don't know about this. But that for me was like, I don't know where else to go. There was Al-Anon, but I could not go to Al-Anon, because if I did, that meant that he was really an alcoholic. And as long as I could think that maybe he was, then maybe he wasn't. And so I met this man, and he went down what I now know, hear you all say, is this checklist. Does he? Does he? Is he? Does he? And I sat there with tears streaming down my eyes going, oh my God, I can't believe this. He has confirmed for me what I so dreaded. The drinking was quite different from time to time, and for me it seemed all the same because the results were just the same. Same thing happened. And so when we moved here and I realized what our new reality was, what I declared to him 6 months after coming here in 1982, January of 1983. I declared to him, I'm going to something called Al-Anon Family Groups. And he did what I knew he would do. He absolutely became furious. Now, Tom was never physically abusive, but he had been very emotionally and verbally abusive. And he lost it. He lost every shred of decency he had, became very angry. And he said to me those words I hear some of my dear AA friends say every now and then. We talk, in fact, my dear friend Sam over there said this morning, he said, you're going to talk about Tom? Well, you know what? In that meeting, they didn't talk about the alcoholics. They talked about problems in their recovery. And I went, that is really strange. I want to talk about him. And they didn't do that. I remember also feeling, I'm so scared to go get out of my car. It was a little meeting in Franklin, Tennessee, downtown, Five Points, First Presbyterian Church parking lot. And I remember getting out of my car and looking around to make sure there was nobody I knew. Because I went to church across the street. And I absolutely would have died if anybody had seen me walk in that church. They would have probably asked me, you know, what are you doing there? And I was always taught to be honest and tell the truth. Well, truth is, I never really always did. I'd have made up something. Nevertheless, I did go to that first meeting, and I will tell you, I watched people smile in that room, and I thought that was pretty unique. After all, this was I had a very dire problem, and they didn't tell me what I wanted them to tell me. Tell me one more thing I can do. One more thing that I can do. You know, I thought I had tried it all. If I could look good enough, if I could cook good enough, if I could be the kind of woman that he thought he wanted in his life. If, you know, I never really tried to keep up with his drinking. A lot of Al-Anon members have tried that. Not this child. Just couldn't drink. He would say to me, that beer is mighty warm. Don't you want another one that's cold? I'm a sipper. And a tripper, I guess. You know, I didn't enjoy it. It didn't do a thing for me at all. And so, you know, I just needed somebody to tell me. Just tell me what to do, and I'll do it. Lord knows I have tried. And in the meantime, what I hadn't realized is that I'd become incredibly obsessed. I had taken the control that I felt from Tom, and that very much was real in our family, and turned it on our son. Well, I can't control him, but I'm going to control this child. And today I will tell you, he's not an alcoholic, but he is a child of an alcoholic home. He has my disease. He has my disease of poor decision making. He has my disease of fear. He has my disease, thank you, Michael. He has my disease of of trying to be better, trying to be what other people want him to be. I can look at him today, and he's the mirror of what we were in our family. We were, you know, with the progressiveness of Tom's disease, I knew that I could not, in good conscience, bring another child, to agree to bring another adopted child into our home. Although that's what we had wanted, but I couldn't do that. And at one time I thought in one of those moments when I thought, maybe he's better, you know, maybe he'll stop. It was all about stopping, you know, and you just stop. For a non-alcoholic, y'all, that seems so easy. Just stop. Well, anyway, we I don't know. I think that I know why I continue to go to Al-Anon. I have never, in the since that date, January, it was January 11th, 1983, I've never not gone to Al-Anon. It has become a way of life for me. It is, it has been for me, truly a new way of life. Took me a while to take that first step, had a terrible time. I am not powerless. And they'd say, Joyce just put, admitted that you're powerless over people, places, and things. Well, I'm not. I'm just not, you know, and I heard people, and I still hear girls say, and guys say, you know, I'm not powerless over that. Well, take a look a little closer, you'll probably find out. And I think, though, that that finally set in, but the second part of that step, first step, nah, I'm not unmanageable. Mm-mm. I've been manageable all my life. I've been, you know, I've done what my mom and dad said to do. I followed the pattern that they set for me. You do this, you do this, you do this, you know. And then finally, I remember my sponsor, and by the way, I did get a sponsor, and if you don't have one, please get one. I was one of those people that didn't think I needed one. I know what this is about. I know I don't need help. I don't need you. I don't. And she said to my sponsor said to me one day, she said, Joyce, what have you been doing today? And this was before sobriety came this time. And I said, well, and I started in on what the latest was. And she said, no, I didn't. I didn't ask you about him. I asked you what you were doing and what you've been thinking about. And I said, him. And she said, don't you see how unmanageable your life is, your thinking is? And that was the difference for me. My life was, my thinking was unmanageable. I looked pretty normal to outside people. You know, I did, I mean, I worked really hard at being manageable so that you all wouldn't know what was going on in our family. You couldn't know. And I didn't want anybody to know. And I must tell you here at this point that I was what we call, I call, a stuffer. I stuffed everything. I stuffed all my anger, my fears, everything. I stuffed it all inside. And I knew that when you do that, I've heard, I mean, I'm not dumb to think that at some point or another that's going to blow. And but, you know, and I did from time to time. And what came out of my mouth was not very nice or very pretty. And it certainly, you know, we talk about what's our motive. That was definitely our motive. My motive was to hurt him like he was hurting me verbally. And it, I don't know if it worked. I have no idea. But, you know, I played a part in the family. I was very much a part of the family disease. And that's why I go to Al-Anon, is because my life has been affected by someone's drinking. You know, I learned that it wasn't for me to say he's an alcoholic. It's for him to say that. And so I try to say today that my life has been affected by someone else's drinking. You know, I believed in God. I'd always believed in God, but God was up in heaven, and he didn't really care a whole lot about individual people. He had so many other things to be concerned about. And the world, I mean, good grief, what a big job. And I thought, you know what? I know he doesn't really care a whole lot about what's going on in my life. And I remember thinking, they keep talking about, you know, relationship with God, your higher power, actually was what I would hear. And I knew and I defined my God. But coming to believe that he could really help me was really challenging for me. I've come to understand that why that is, has been for me, or was for me, was that I never had a relationship with him. And so it seemed to make sense to me, and I've got to internalize and make sense of things in order for, you know, all of this to work. But I began to realize, you know, except for just a few in this room, I don't know you at all. much as I didn't know my higher power. I knew you, but I didn't. And how could I trust somebody if I didn't know them? You know, I had to know you in order to try to trust you. So my sponsor suggested I begin working on my relationship with my higher power, that he was the one that I needed to go to with a lot of these things. And what she also, I would say to her, you know what, I need a person. And she said, I remember her saying, don't you get it? You know, this, we, all of us in this meeting are God with flesh on. We're all here to share a story of recovery with you. We are the instruments that God has placed on your path to help you. Go to meetings, read your literature, be of service. So, you know, that part began for me. And like I say, I'm not sure why I kept going, except I honestly think that was God doing for me that which I had not been willing to do any other way. I was, you know, I just stayed. I didn't understand you. I didn't want to do what you wanted me to do. I was desperate and I had no other place to go. It was the one place I could talk and share and feel safe. Because everywhere else, I couldn't trust anybody else. I just couldn't trust anybody else. I certainly couldn't trust Tom. He had worn out that completely, it seemed. And, you know, for me, when I began to trust that God would take care of me, my life began to change. And I would call my sponsor and I'd say, I don't know what to do. And she said to me, I'd say to her, I want a divorce. And she said, well, have you talked to God about it? And I'd say, yes, I've told him I want a divorce. And she said, all right, then what has God said to you? And I would say, I don't know. But I'd hear these snippets in meetings like, you know, when you don't know, when you're confused about what to do, don't do anything. Well, that seemed to be where I was. I didn't get any clear sign that I was when I was supposed to leave. I wanted to believe it. I still believed that God didn't put me on this earth to live with this chronic alcoholic living that way. You know, I thought, I'm watching somebody kill themselves, and it hurts. And I've got choices. I learned in Al-Anon that I have choices. And I thought, oh, this is just a God-given gift for me. So she, you know, she said to me, God will let you know when it's time. He did. And you'll hear more about that from Tom. But the point of it is, it came that day. It was a day that I hadn't planned would happen. And that, to me, is the difference. When I'm planning what I'm going to say and when I'm going to say it, that begins to be my will. When it's, you know, doing the footwork and letting God decide, have a solution, we say, letting him have it, then if that's what he wants to happen, it'll happen. And you just have to be patient with that. And so that began a new chapter. And that was the day that I honestly can tell you I trusted my higher power completely. And for the most part, I can tell you that today, I truly believe that because God is now a part of my life, he's a part of my decision making. If it doesn't feel right, then I stop and take a step back and think about what I'm supposed to do and where I'm supposed to go and anything else. And we've put that in practice in our coupleship, and it works. Moving right along very quickly, unbeknownst to me, that particular day was Tom's last drinking day. I wouldn't have believed it possible. Because in my mind, I was playing God, and I knew that he was just never going to get sobriety. I had taken some steps. My sponsor said, do the work, do the footwork, do the footwork. Well, part of that was getting work, finding a job. So I found two jobs. I mean, why get one when you can get two? got two jobs. You know, they were part-time jobs, so they seemed to serve the purpose at the time. Got a credit card, just began to take care of myself and put the focus on me and less on him. I had an old-timer who'd say to me, Joyce, she had this real raspy voice, Joyce, she'd say, put your blinders on. And I looked at her with this, what are you talking about? And she said, don't you know what blinders are? And I said, no. She said, those are the things they put on horses to keep them focused. Put your blinders on. And oh my gosh, that was so hard for me. My sponsor said, get busy, do the fourth step. And I said, I don't need to do that. I know who I am. She said, smiled at me in that sweet way she can, and she said, okay. And you know, God uses everything that you all say and every instance for me today if I just allow it and become aware of it. I began to feel terribly guilty because other people were talking about working their fourth step and I hadn't done mine. So we have a book called Blueprint for Progress. And the way I took it, yes, no, maybe, sometimes, yes, no. And there's a section in, I think it's Pastor Recovery that talks about taking your inventory that way. You know, it's to no avail. I mean, it's like, and I knew it, but I didn't care. I could say to you, I've done it. I was later to do other inventories, I will tell you that. But what I really didn't want to look at was me. I didn't want to look because I could not get past that ego that said everything's right with you. It's still just the alcoholic, you know. So, nevertheless, I continued to work those steps when it came to admitting to God and to someone else and myself the errors of my ways. I had a terrible time with that. I couldn't imagine telling people some of the things that I had done. And my sweet sponsor said, you know what? I've done that too. And I went, oh, I've waited so long to share this. And when I do, she's going, you know, I am the worst problem I have. My head is a dangerous place to be, very dangerous place to be. I found humility in these steps. I took, you know, my list of people that I needed to make amends to. For the most part, I've done those. I know I have one left. And I just haven't found quite, I probably have found the right time and place to do it, but God knew I wasn't quite ready. And I want to do it when I'm sincere and genuine. And I think that's the key in doing that personal step. I don't have much time left, but I do want to tell you that Tom got a sponsor when he first got sober this time, and he had a kick in the rear end kind of sponsor, and his sponsor said, get in the car, we're going to do, and you know, so he was gone all the time. I hear this so often now, well, he's always gone, or she's always gone to meetings, or whatever, and honestly, I didn't resent the meetings. I didn't really resent any of it, but I did think it was kind of strange that still he wasn't home. It was like, well, how can I work on this if he's not home? And the truth is, I need still a lot of work on me. And he was just doing what he needed to do. And when I hear an Al-Anon member describe, and we even talks about that in our literature, about how some family members, get really bent out of shape about that. Well, get over it is all I can say. Because it's important. It's their medicine. It's what you need. And what I need today is to continue going to a program because my life has been affected. And in a heartbeat, You know, on any kind of given day, I can still need my program. I need to pull the tool out of the bag on how to handle. This program for me is a set of solutions for my problems, and our literature talks about that. He got into service, and I thought, well, I'll just go do something. I don't know. I went to my first district meeting, and I was a secretary, and I, heaven knows, I'm not a secretary. Take terrible notes. I'm a listener and not a writer, and I'm a talking person. But that kind of was the hook that got me into service. And I'm oh so glad for that, because it has, I've learned so much through service, but the most important thing is learning that how to live with you, how to work with you, how to be a part of and not the controller, the leader, in my world, my old world, I was either a soldier or a leader, and I wanted to be the leader, but the truth was I needed a lot of help on me before I could lead. And so I stayed involved in service, and I have had a wonderful opportunity to be at World Service Conference, and that's a marvelous place. What an eye-opener. It was just unbelievable for me. A couple of last things. Sobriety had been with us for just a brief time, and I wanted some fun. You know, we'd gone through a lot of years of staying home and can't do this because you don't know if he's going to be drinking and all this insanity. And we looked around to see if there were some couples that we could do some things with who were non-drinkers. I knew that would be a little better for Tom, because I didn't want him, you know, I still thought that you had control over his drinking. And so we didn't have any couples, but about 6 months later, there were some couples that we began to notice. We found out about how to do a couples gathering. And the marvelous thing is that people came, God put some people in our lives as couples that we could gather with once a month and share. And I thought, I don't know if I can share in front of Tom. I don't know if I can share how I really feel, because you see, in active alcoholism, we learn not to share how we feel. We don't know. We don't know how we feel. We just know we're angry and we're really ticked off. And so I learned to share in front of him with no recourse. You know, he's never said, "Why did you say that?" You know, and I was shocked, because I fully expected him to come back with a harsh comment or criticism, because that's the way it had always been. Today, our couples group is still moving along. It still meets every month, and it's a marvelous experience. We learn how to be in a relationship, and we didn't know how to do that. Didn't know how to do that. I wanted to close today with a brief sharing out of Al-Anon's 12 and 12. There is a place in the back. It's called the epilogue. And I don't know if I can share this as well with you as I can read it. So I'm going to just read, it's about two or three paragraphs, brief things, because I normally don't read up here. But this is really, for those of you who wonder about this thing called Al-Anon, and you wonder why we still go and what we do, you know, what we do at those meetings, the writer of this says, and I'm picking up here on the comment, "I felt as though I were groping around in a terrifying dark cave. No matter how desperately I prayed and struggled, I felt trapped. There seemed no way out of the hopeless confusion of my life. Suddenly, someone, a stranger, took me by the hand and led me around a turn in the cave that opened up into a tunnel dotted by a row of lights. He led me as far as the first light and said, "Just keep following the lights and you'll be all right." I didn't care where they led as long as I could get out of the deep despair where I was living. As I walked from one light to the next, the path through the tunnel became brighter and my fears gradually faded. Finally, there came the brightest light of all. Sunshine. Whoops, let me see if I can read this. let's see where I left off. Sunshine and freedom. The lights were our 12 steps and our 12 traditions, which kept showing me the way out of my confusion. And with them, I felt, and I say feel, wholly secure. So that's what Al-Anon has done for this family, this Al-Anon member. It's given me my life back. The wonderful Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous has given me my husband back. He's not the ogre that I thought he was. He's actually a much better version of the man before our marriage. The kind person, the thoughtful person that he can be. This is a family disease, and everyone receives the water droplets from the shaking dog. So thank you so much to the committee, and I didn't thank you beforehand. Thank you for inviting me to speak. I truly am privileged. Thank you.